Welcome to Disrupt Disruption, a series of intimate interviews with global thought leaders and practitioners operating at the intersection of business, leadership, and technology. We're discussing all things innovation and disruption and how to not only survive, but thrive in these times of exponentially accelerating change. Trusted by CEOs, founders, and leaders globally for the latest take on business models, methods, culture, and leadership, we cut to the chase, debunk the hype, and get real. You're in great company. I'm your host, Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical. All right, everybody. This is Pascal. I am super stoked to be here with a dear friend, an old colleague of mine, and literally the first person I bumped into when I was at Singularity University and I did my first stint at Singularity University in the office, Kyle Nell. So Kyle has an amazing background in really making stuff happen. Used to work for Walmart, then became the director of Lowe's Innovation Lab, where he did incredible stuff like putting a 3D printer into space, building the first augmented reality, literally physical spaces where you could explore the world of Lowe's and build your own new bathroom in an augmented reality world way before anyone else did this. Then built a company called Uncommon Partners, which is a beautiful name and exactly the name is what's inside of the company. Sold that company to Singularity University and now is the president of Singularity Labs, where he continues to not only think about, but actually build the future. So with that being said, Kyle, super stoked to have you.
Are you kidding? Thank you so much. Good to be here.
Kyle, let me kick off with a question I love to ask everybody, because disruption is this, you know, I like to call it a tofu word. It just doesn't mean anything to anyone anymore. Very similar to tofu, which doesn't taste like anything. How do you even define it? Like, where do you come from? When you think about disruption, Like what is the working assumption for you there?
Yeah, I think the better way to, for, at least for me, is to not use the word innovation, because like you said, it's like the word natural. It means absolutely nothing, right? You could have natural Skittles. How does that work? Sorry, Mars. But the on the other side, if you replace it with a different word, it kind of has more meaning. So for me, I like to use the word transformation. So there's kind of two types of transformation. There's little t transformations, like small innovations, small transformations. And then there's like transformation or innovation is where hopefully these little ones are laddering up. And thinking about it that way, I find helps me to think about it in a different way. And it helps the other person on the other side or people on the other side to think about it. Okay, transformation means I have to do something or something's going to be done, where innovation feels almost more passive, more, oh, it's happening out there, or it's more ethereal. Whereas transformation is like transformation. So, and that for me is what innovation, true innovation really is. It's a true change rather than talking about it or feeling good about something.
If you, and I know you've done multiple times, go into an organization and you bring transformation, or your mandate is to bring transformation, how do you go about it? What is the ground truth for you?
Yeah. So this happens all the time. And I know this happens with you too, right? So you get all of these executives that say, we've got to change, or something's going on, or new group of people come in and they want to be the champions of innovation and transformation. And so they hire people like us that seem like we know what we're doing and spend time in California. And then that's how they're going to fix things. But what they almost without fail have never really taken an opportunity to really think, what happens if these people are actually successful in coming up with a blueprint for how we change? And oh yeah, by the way, they're probably going to come up with something that's different than what I'm thinking. And even more importantly, different than what I'm good at. Right. And what I find over and over and over again, no matter the industry that folks are in, is that they are there at the top because they were naturally selected at being the best in the pre-existing or the currently existing business model. So they just grew up and they rose to the top because they were so naturally selected at being good. And then when they get to the top, they're told to change, or they feel the need to change. And then change shows up and then they're like, I physically cannot do what is required to get to this next thing. And because I'm not going to be a part of it, I'm just going to shut it down. I'll take your adorable presentation and whatever it is, and I'll say that was great, and I'll put it on a shelf and I'll pay you your money, but nothing's going to happen. And that's something that I see all the time. So if you start backwards and you say, what if, it's very likely that what we're going to uncover here is going to make you and your skills obsolete and unnecessary. What happens then? and really challenge them on it. If I can see their reaction and see they're truly committed to actually making this change, then those are the kind of clients and folks I want to work with. But I would say the vast majority do not want to do that, even though they say all the right things. And that ultimately leads to, how are you going to change? You have to really be willing to transform and willing to change. It's like people who don't want to go to the doctor, even though they know that something's really wrong, because they don't want to hear what's wrong. And it doesn't change the fact that there's something underlying wrong. But if you go to the doctor, then maybe there's a way to fix it. If you have that relationship with it, and that's where the transformation is there, you can really start to do a lot of change. And most of the change is pretty basic. It really doesn't require something that is technical or technological per se. But usually it's something very basic, like what are we going to become and who do we need to get there? And what do we need to change to become that?
How do you go about this? So first step is the litmus test, essentially. It sounds also as a fairly binary thing, right? Like you either want transformation or you don't, really.
Right. Right.
And deal with the consequences of transformation. Once you've established that, how do you go about the transformation part itself? Say you found the executive who says, yes, I'm with you. I know we need to change. I know I need to change. It will look differently. Yeah. Let's go.
So my model has always been three basic pieces. And I've been doing this for a while now, and I both myself and for others, and I've never seen it fall apart. So there are three things. One, you have to have a strategic narrative. You have to have a real narrative with characters, conflict, and a narrative arc of where you're here and where you're going with a high degree of clarity. Like, this is where we're going and this is the time horizon, but you don't have to have any certainty. Like, these are the actual steps. And then you have to have a real pathway for how you would break the bottlenecks inside of your organization and without to make that a reality. You have to be willing to break some stuff or to massage some stuff or to really go and change those things inside in order to make that real. And then lastly, you have to have new metrics of success to be able to measure the new stuff. And usually the best way to do that is just to not use whatever you're doing to measure your mature business to measure the new stuff. And you have to have that. If you have those three pieces, you can do incredible things. I mean, everyone talks about the moonshot from John F. Kennedy, and it's awesome, right? But he did that. Like, he did strategic narrative. Very clearly, we're going to put a man on the moon and bring him back again by the end of the decade. No idea how that's going to happen, or very little idea. You have to go to Congress, get money. You have to go to the rest of NATO, get their support. And then you have to have new measures to be able to assess how all these different rockets are working and how all these things are working in order to get that to happen. And you can see that over where they are able to hold that together and then they keep recycling it over and over and over and over again. And one of the reasons I think we all hold true to so many of these big luminaries like Edison, I mean, you can call them whatever you want, but many of these other folks is they're really good at the front end piece of telling a strategic narrative and coming back around again. And that it's really that simple. So that's always the second question, Pascal. Like, I always ask them, so what's your strategic narrative? And I explain very briefly what it is. And they'll usually give me some stupid strategy nonsense in a 2x2 grid. That's not a narrative. People don't get excited about a 2x2 grid. People don't know how they fit in a 2x2 grid. And when you have the strategic narrative, a lot of people can ladder up to that in ways that you don't have to control. And that's how you create something really big and something really transformational.
You and I have been in this world where we and our colleagues at Singularity University, for example, we talk about this idea around the core edge. They need to be different. They need to be merged. I'm curious with your idea around and your narrative or vocabulary around the transformation, particularly the capital T transformation, of course, here in our context. How do you think about core and edge? How do you think about organizational structure?
Yeah. So this is the hard part. So really, it depends on where we're coming in the organization, right? So if it's an executive coming in from a large organization, then we should be the edge. But you have to have the core bought into the idea that we are all going on a transformational narrative. And what that does then is if you do it the right way, then we're all going in the right direction. Because the natural thing that happens is there's the new people and there's the old people. And the old people passively aggressively fight the new people at best, or just out and out battle them. And the new people hate the old people because they're dumb and they're slow and they're blocking. And that is the surefire way to kill anything and to keep anything from going on. So again, the strategic narrative thing is so powerful because you can say, okay, here's where we're going as an organization. And it's then require each individual group, even the accounting department, to then their goals for that year, to write them in a narrative way, not something super hard or complicated, but in a narrative way, how what they're doing ladders up to where the company's going. Then all of the people in the accounting department know that what they're doing is on strategy. It's on mission. They don't have to wonder. They don't have to ask. They don't have to worry if they're the in-group or the out-group. They know, and even down to the individual contributor level, they can then talk to how they're helping to, in one way or the other, help to ladder it up. Even the janitorial services, I mean, those folks are helping to clean the building so that we can do X. And that is a very different thing, again, than showing some silly 2x2 grid of where we're at and where we want to go.
How do you reconcile in that context the necessity to maintain the core, which might be very different to what the future looks like? Right. Yeah. You've got like two essentially competing narratives probably going on, but you need the core to generate the cash flow to finance the other stuff.
Yeah. That's exactly right. So at Lowe's, it's another good example. We had a mission. The mission of Lowe's was to help people love where they live. Right. So that was the basis of what Lowe's did. And so what we would say is we help people love where they live by seeding the future today. So all of the stuff that we were doing, so again, takes the sting out of like, how is this going to make money? You're doing this and it's so small compared to what's going on here. Well, you can see that if you're very clear as to what your role is in relation to everybody else's, the core group needs to keep spinning out and doing their thing and doing it really well in their space. They're succeeding in that mission, but there has to be somebody else who's also looking further out and laying the groundwork and laying the track that gets us to the future. Because if you don't, it very quickly you run to the end of the road before you realize it. I mean, that's usually, Pascal, when people call you, people like you and me, like, the world is over. That is the worst time to call us, because that is when people make panicky decisions. The best time to do it is when things are working really well and to start to lay out the track that could give you much bigger options for the future. So that's what I always say is find in relation, the thing on the core that you're building, find it, how it relates to the current, and help people understand where they fit into the larger narrative of where it's going. Otherwise, again, you get this unhealthy and unnecessary internal competition.
How do you think about the practical doing? I remember at Lowe's, you had your lab unit, you probably brought in outside talent. That seems to be a fairly common occurrence. I know other companies who basically say, no, we need to nurture the inside talent. And that's how we build the cohesion in the organization. How do you think about that?
Yeah, it's complicated, right? Because each organization is different. But the fundamental idea is there, like, and many people have said this in many different ways, there are more smart people outside your organization than inside. And if you really want to do something new, you should probably talk to somebody who you don't usually talk to. And that's why it's, for me, it's all about uncommon partners. And that is one of the things that I do business by and I live by, which is you should work with people that when you say, I work with, or I'm doing this, and there are people who are like, what? Or that seems weird. Then you know when you're on the right track, because guess what? Your competitors probably aren't talking to them. And they're not getting those ideas. They're not finding those collaborations. And then a partnership too, where you really partner with somebody. And this is the part that I think people can pay lip service to, but is incredibly difficult to do, which is to really partner. And when I mean really partner, you have difficult conversations with people because you are invested in the relationship. Like, Pascal, I remember early days when I was at Lowe's, starting the Lowe's Innovation Labs, and there was, I think I maybe had two employees, and we were nothing at the time. And I came in to work at Singularity, moved my family to California, and I started finding partners to work with within the SU universe. I remember I had one in particular that we were doing good stuff, but then we were having some interpersonal conflict about trying to get stuff. And I won't name names, but I if you remember this, and I called, we called you in to kind of mediate the conversation. Now, for me, it would have been easier as the vendor to just be like, this guy is not doing what he's supposed to do. I don't feel supported. So I'm just going to drop off the face of the earth and we're never going to re-up again. The harder thing to do is to have a hard conversation and even bring somebody else in to help you facilitate it, because you care enough about trying to take this relationship as far as you can go. And that's not going to always work out. That's what a partner does. You do that. And I find that large organizations are really bad at this. I mean, one of the first ways you engage somebody is by dropping a 40-page MSA on them. And you're like, I'm two people. You're going to bankrupt my organ, my tiny little co with legal bills, just going through this thing before we can even talk. So all of the different things, like how can we find better ways of working with people we wouldn't normally work with? And then really having the orientation towards partnership, that is really cool. And then the last thing I'll say about that too is on the partnership exchange, the way that large organizations always like to work is they try to give you cash. And that's not always a bad thing. But cash is probably the worst currency to trade with when you're looking for a partner. There's so many other things that you could trade with. You could trade with your brand association. So one of the things we would do is we would make videos with early stage startups that we're working with, because we knew that one of the biggest values was, we gave them money, of course, but one of the biggest values was to show that we were partnering with them, because then they could go around and go raise money, get other clients, because we were on YouTube, on our channel. There's other ways to partner with folks to give them stuff that doesn't cost you any money, but it might make you a little uncomfortable. You might have to have a conversation with the PR department, the comms department, but that's the kind of stuff that you will start to come up with if you're thinking about a partner mindset rather than a vendor-vendee relationship. And that's how you get to real cool stuff. Because guess what? That vendor, that partner is going to start bringing you stuff that isn't on the SOW. They're going to start bringing you other partners. That's the virtuous cycle that goes around and comes around over and over again.
That all being said, and you already alluded to some of the pitfalls, the traps, the things organizations, organizational leaders, et cetera, might fall into or might do wrong. If you have this hit list, you know, my Spotify playlist of here's the stuff which seems to be going wrong all the time, and like the stuff I look out for, as in beware, be careful that this doesn't happen to you. What would you put on that list?
On the innovation side or on the inside corporate side?
I think on the innovation side, on the transformation side, as we've learned.
Well, number one, the biggest thing is if you're having meetings that go well internally and everyone tells you you're great, but then you don't see any movement. That's one of my biggest red flags, that you are innovation theater. And it's very easy when you have somebody that can come in and give a good talk or can show some really rough prototype and people can get excited, and then there's no interest in actually doing anything with it. That is one of the biggest pitfalls. And the best way for me to help others see is to, are you having big presentations or meetings, and then they never go anywhere beyond another presentation or other meeting? That's a pretty good sign you're in the pit of theater. The other part that's really hard is when they find something that has a little bit of traction, the natural inclination of large organizations is to smother it with cash and with attention. And that will surely kill it. Surely kill it. And you, I know you've seen this. I've seen this so many times, where you can kill it with love just as fast as you can kill it through letting it die by not taking care of it. So if you understand that both sides, both extremes are bad, then you can set guardrails very quickly to say, going back to strategic narrative, we're trying to achieve this. I'm not trying to make something that's incrementally better that'll make us a couple $100 million in the next 3 years. I'm trying to make us a couple $1 billion in the next 5 years. And that's a completely different way of looking at things that really requires somebody to be comfortable with saying no to senior people. And you can say no, but, and that's a hard conversation to have. But if you've already decided before the money shows up, then that's a much easier conversation than in the moment. So I would say those two things together. You can fall into this innovation theater dilemma, and you can also fall into the let's scale problem as well before it's ready. And only way you can do that again is by having new measures of success that are quantitative in nature that allows you to be less emotional about it and less reactionary to what's happening and more look at the long view. And it all just comes from laying out and making this more of a rigorous, structured exercise than let's just go find cool stuff and just try this fail fast idea where you just throw stuff against the wall and see what sticks. That's garbage. I'm sorry. That's the most ridiculous idea. You can turn this into a structured system and have a ton of success. And still, that structure creates a massive amount of creativity. It doesn't kill it, actually. Structure creates creativity when done correctly.
You already spoke about the idea about metrics, KPIs, et cetera. How do you think about the KPIs? Are you tying them into sales usage, or is there a whole different spectrum you would like to look at?
Whole different spectrum. So sales typically almost always is the thing that I hate as a metric for something new, because there's always a metric. They're always tracking sales on the mature side. So the mature sales system is going to be far bigger, far more impressive, and far more immediate than anything new. So one of the best ways that I found to gather new insight and to compare and contrast is just measuring humans. And I'm not talking about surveys. You know, I'm big on the neuroscience side. So we still do put EEG headsets and eye tracking goggles on people. And you can literally measure the cognitive load and the interest and the emotional valence in real time of anything, whether it's virtual reality or an in-store shelf or a website. I mean, ultimately, that is the only thing that matters. You're trying to gather cognition and motivation. And that's it. So for me, understanding the human aspect is a great and very actionable set of metrics that you can do something with that is not sales. And so you can bring that really awesome skill set to bear that allows you to compare all of these things and then at the same time keep the sales monster away. That's always what I push for. And I've yet to find anything better than measuring it through EEG and eye tracking. I'm sure there are others, but it's worked really well for us.
Let me ask a last question. I have an assumption. I know what the answer for you will be, but I love to ask this. It's always my closing questions. If you think about large corporations, the incumbents of this world, in aggregate, can they actually even do this stuff? Or are they doomed because of their structure?
Doomed because of their structure. I'll be honest. They don't want to change. And so they create structures around them that they call stability, which are really just self-reinforcing prisons that slow the demise. And whenever I see companies do stock buybacks as a way of generating value, or they do other things that aren't actually creating value, but that are creating value through monetary measures, it's not a bad thing. I think it's a smart thing to do, but that shouldn't be your primary way of generating value moving forward. Whenever I start to see that, I always think, oh, this is just not going to work out very well. Because change in and of itself is a difficult and not fun thing. When we talk about the stories, we talk about the aftermath, right? When you're in the middle of it, it's incredibly hard. And even for you and me, it's hard for me. Every time I start a new company or start a new thing, it is both exciting and terrifying and incredibly hard. And so to think that that won't happen at an exponential scale in an exponentially large organization, and you're not willing to go through that pain and suffering. And then the other part is these executives that are making these decisions, whether they be on the board or the C-suite or whatever, they are not incentivized to change. They're incentivized to squeeze as much juice out of that turnip. So they're financially not incentivized, nor are they biologically set up for it, because we're just not. Of course, that's why no one really changes fast enough in order to catch the next wave or to build the next track to the future. There are a few organizations that do it very well, but they found ways to unstructure the structure in order to make it the new way that they get stuff done, or that's just the way that they always get stuff done. And those companies, you see them, they are able to reinvent themselves over and over again. But those are the exception, not the rule. So just to reiterate, I would say they're not doomed, but they're dooming themselves. They're causing it, their own demise.
Carl, quite frankly, on that cautionary, optimistic note, thank you so much. This was super insightful. I love all the insights we pulled out here around this idea of transformation instead of innovation and disruption. I absolutely love that. I'm a huge fan of reframing things in different words, which are actually more tangible. Love the idea around the narrative, the storytelling. And I know, of course, you've written a book about this, so highly recommend reading that. Love the insights you have in terms of how do you actually approach this from a leadership perspective, and also the honesty that it is really hard work. And at the same time, it's exciting. I want to
add. Oh, yeah.
So, Kyle, thank you so much. This was awesome.
Thanks, Pascal. Appreciate it.
Hey, it's Pascal. Thanks for tuning in on this episode of Disrupt Disruption. If you want more, check out the other episodes we have on this podcast. Also know that this is part of an effort of us writing a book about disruption. So keep your eyes and ears peeled towards that. And if you liked it, do us a favor. Go on your podcasting platform of choice, iTunes, Google Play, whatever it is, and just like this. There's some weird algorithm thing, which, you know, if you like it, they will like us. So do me a favor, do that. And if you've got any questions, any comments, anyone I should talk to, drop us an email. Easiest email address for me to reach it is p, just the letter p, at finet.com. With that being said, thank you so much for listening, and I will hear you here soon.